Second Court of Appeals. It's my understanding the attorneys have checked in and they're ready to begin. Before we do begin, though, I want to introduce the panel to you. To my right is Justice Dana Womack. To my left is Justice Brian Walker, and I'm Bonnie Sutter, the Chief Justice of the Court. And before argument begins, I'll ask the clerk to please call the case.
The court will now call Kendra Anderson, a.k.a. on the Beloved Truth versus the state of Texas. May please the court, Mr. Brian Cabrera will argue for the appellant, and Mr. Brian Woolfield will argue for the case.
You may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Justices, and may it please the Court. A demoted officer who failed to comply with basic constitutional safeguards. A pro se defendant who was consequently charged with retaliation against a peace officer. And two prosecutors who, to their credit, belatedly made judicial admissions that the statements forming the basis of the offense should have been excluded and disregarded. We're here for a case that may have never happened if demoted officer Malwitz had simply said a few words to comply with the constitutional safeguards required in Miranda and then also in Article 38.22 of the Code of Criminal Procedure. The core of the case today is this. Honesty is asking this court simply to require an officer to take a few seconds to say a few words that would have protected her rights. What the state is asking this court to do today is to provide it a blueprint in how to interrogate a defendant, regardless of her susceptibility, regardless of her unusual disorientation and anger, how to interrogate someone without complying with those duties. And we're asking the court to deny that blueprint, to find that the officer should have said those few words, and to reverse and remand for a new trial. I'm going to discuss issue two first before I turn to issue one. Just to be frank with the court, if each of you had 1 hour to look at the issues and write an opinion, we would ask you probably to use 55 minutes of that on issue two. We do believe issue one has a real issue, but we acknowledge that the state of the precedent weighs against us, and I'll turn to that towards the end of my argument. I do want to clarify a few preliminary matters relating to issue two. The first is that all the conversation germane to issue two can be seen on State's Exhibit 11, and I just want to recite the timestamps that I believe are germane to that. That would be from the 15-minute mark to 16:53, and then from 26:30 to the end of State's Exhibit 11. I believe that everything is contained in that video exhibit. I also want to clarify the factual analysis in my brief. My brief begins discussing the interrogation or question-answer format a little bit later than what's actually shown in the body cam, and so I just want to clarify that the actual interactions between Honesty and Officer Malwitz began a little bit earlier than my briefing. He initially asked her, if I recall correctly, how are you doing back there, Honesty, when she's placed in the patrol unit. She begins basically asking to make a phone call, and there's a little bit of back and forth about that. After, I think, a minute or two, Officer Malwitz then begins with his first, what I consider interrogative question, where he asks, what about the stuff you threw behind the shed? And then Honesty responds by saying, that was planted on me, et cetera, et cetera. During this time in the body cam video, State's Exhibit 11, Officer Malwitz is driving his patrol unit. At one point, he parks it, and even though he's parked and could exit at that time, he asks the first question, which I note in my brief, which is, why didn't we just talk about it? Why did you start screaming at me and stuff? And so I just want to clarify that the body cam video reflects conversation a little bit earlier than I began my briefing. So I just want to point that out to the court. Of course, Honesty believes that actually helps her case for issue two, but I'll turn to that in just a moment.
Counselor, real quick, let me ask you a question. So I guess what's your response that the state alleges that her assertions, her statements were not made in response to questions or to interrogation?
So, Your Honor, we would argue that the interrogation is a continuum that begins with the very first question he asked her relating to any of the offenses, which is, what about the stuff you threw behind the shed? Because that relates to possession of marijuana, that relates to the tampering for which he was arrested. His additional questions are interspersed throughout his conversation with her, all the way from then going towards the jail, include, why did you start screaming at us? Why did you resist arrest? We believe that the interrogation begins at, why'd you throw the stuff behind the shed? And everything after that should have been excluded.
This is probably a question more for the appellee, but can you think of any reason why those kinds of questions wouldn't be considered interrogation?
If I understand the argument in their briefing correctly, they're saying that Honesty did not respond to those questions immediately subsequent with a response that was incriminating. However, I think one good way to think about this entire continuum of unabated interspersed questioning is you can imagine the classic scenario where a defendant is arrested, they're taken to a station house for questioning, right? And I think anyone who's practiced in criminal jurisprudence can probably imagine that they're stuck in a little room. The officer may begin some kind of colloquial things. Do you want a Gatorade? Oh, I see you're wearing a Ranger shirt. You know, how about the Rangers? You may come back and then ask, well, where'd you hide the murder weapon? Now, that may not immediately get the defendant to respond subsequently after that question with an incriminating response, but the detectives, as we can see in a lot of criminal cases, will intersperse their questioning. They'll use a continuum of tactics that under Ennis would constitute interrogation. And just because a defendant doesn't immediately respond with an incriminating response doesn't mean that they were not compelled to do so under Ennis v. Rhode Island.
Yeah, and well, yeah. I mean, I guess in normal conversation too, if you ask me a question and then you've had a follow-up question, I might still be thinking about the first question you asked me just because you asked me the question in the interim, you know, doesn't necessarily mean that I've shifted gears as the listener.
And that's exactly the argument we would make, because if we were to hold that as long as it's not the immediate question after or the immediate response after a question, anything else would not be responsive to interrogation. An officer could ask in a station house, where'd you hide the murder weapon? Oh, wait a second, I have to take this call. Walk outside, come back in, say, oh, hey, that was my friend Charlie. And then under the state's viewpoint, even though he asked directly, where'd you hide the murder weapon, because there's a break in time under the state's perspective, suddenly that becomes non-interrogative or non-responsive. And we would argue that that's entirely an incorrect assessment.
But now, she didn't really give an incriminating statement in response to the whatever was going on there. She really just made a threat. And isn't that different? Isn't that a separate offense? What if instead of making a verbal threat, had lunged at the police officer or something like that? Would she still need to be Mirandized?
Your Honor, I think there would be a distinction there between the type of offense that we'd have at issue. Obviously, an assault would be something of physical in nature, and then the retaliation would be, here it was mere words, right?
It was words, but it was words used as a weapon, not words used in response to questioning. That's my point.
We would respectfully disagree, Your Honor, and the reason for that is because even at that juncture, the officers expressed question, and, well, to answer the question, at that particular juncture, the officer asks, you went out at a charge of retaliation to that. Honesty says, is that what I said? And he says, yeah. And we believe that that interaction equates to a measure of compulsion above mere subtle compulsion in accordance with Ennis. And we believe that that interaction did beg Honesty to, I would say, would bait her or lure her into giving a more antagonistic response. That's how we would frame that.
But her statement, how long you think you're going to live, Malwitz, was said before. I mean, he had not asked her any question in the car. I mean, I watched the video, and then he makes a comment, do you want to add terroristic threats? So what was that in response to, her comment?
Your Honor, I would argue that these are all responses to the interrogation that Officer Malwitz began with his very first clearly offense-related question. What about that stuff you threw behind the shed? And then he also follows up later with, why didn't we just talk about it? Why'd you start screaming at me? And I think the way that we would frame this is, even though those questions, those two first questions didn't beg her to respond with a retaliation or a threat, she is under interrogation at that point. And under 38.22, her statements in response to that interrogation should have been excluded. And if we look at Ennis, it lists a certain series of factors that are relevant to determining whether or not the words or actions on the part of the police rise to the level of interrogation. And some of those factors are whether a defendant is peculiarly susceptible to the tactics being used, whether or not the defendant is unusually disoriented or upset, whether the conversation is brief, and we believe that all of those are in favor of honesty here, whether the questions from the officer are offhand remarks to some, whether the officer makes offhand remarks or whether the questioning is targeted to an individual. And just some factors I think are important to note as to why the interrogation begins with the very first offense question. What about the stuff you threw behind the shed? I would just note to the court that honesty was peculiarly susceptible to interrogative tactics here. And that's because even the desk clerk from the hotel mentioned that honesty and a white male had been smoking marijuana. We believe that goes to mental susceptibility. In addition, now Lieutenant Hamilton in his body cam, when he's speaking with Malwitz and the desk clerk, he actually mentions, oh, we're dealing with an activist. We're dealing with a Black Lives Matter person. And he mentions that he knows that because he went to her car and saw some documents or files or something in her, I think he says paperwork in her vehicle. And we believe that also goes to her unusual susceptibility because the officers, knowing that in particular, they should know that she would take it peculiarly offensively if she believed an officer completely violated her legal rights, which is how she felt here. In addition, of course, honesty was unusually disoriented and upset. She was emotional at the very outset of the conversation. I think that's very clear on the body cam. The officer, or Lieutenant Hamilton, testified that she was fighting and she wrestled with us and we pushed her against the wall. We think that adds to her unusual disorientation and her upset. Of course, as you can hear on the body cam, she's cursing, she's boiling with audible, visceral anger, right? And in addition, I would also note that Officer Hamilton uses a compulsion tactic of blaming or characterizing her interaction to kind of egg her on or bait her when he says, why don't we just talk about this? Why'd you start screaming at me? And we believe all those things together show that the interrogative continuum began at that very first question, why'd you throw that stuff behind the shed, and goes onward. Just because there's a break in time between that initial question and her statements that form the basis of the offense, we don't believe that that break makes any difference in the analysis of how we should frame the issue. And did I sufficiently answer your point? I apologize,
Thank you,
Your Honor. Just going back to some threshold issues for the court that I think will help clarify kind of the scope of this case. There's a lot of things not at issue here. We believe that what we're asking the court to do is make a legal holding that is narrow in scope. Of course, here, waiver does not appear to be an issue. Whether this court should consider all the evidence admitted at trial for the suppression issue, we don't believe that's at issue. In addition, that honesty is in custody is not at issue. And frankly, because all of the germane facts are on the body cam, we don't believe that really the underlying facts at issue. And accordingly, we're asking this court essentially to make a de novo evaluation of the circumstances because everything is on body cam and there's no factual credibility determinations to have been made here such that y'all should afford greater factual deference to the trial court's ruling. I do want to go ahead and mention that there are three fulcrums on which I believe that this case can be resolved for issue two. We believe that on any of these three fulcrums, however you decide the interrogation begins and ends, that the statements that should have been excluded under each scenario would still be harmful. The first is this court could say that which is what we're asking, all of honesty statements after the question, what about the stuff you threw behind the shed, should have been excluded. And in that scenario, all the statements would be out, and of course, that would be not only harmful, but probably amount to legal insufficiency. The second fulcrum would be if this court decided that honesty statements from the time she gets into the patrol unit to the time she gets at the jail should be excluded. And that's exactly what the case that's exactly what the state suggested in closing argument when it made its judicial admissions. The third fulcrum would be if this court decided you want to add everything after the Officer Malwitz statement, you want to add terroristic threat, should be excluded. And that would bring this case entirely in line with Mason from the Tyler Court of Appeals. And as I mentioned, under either of these, any of these three fulcrums, we believe that the resulting error would be harmful. But that's kind of how I would break up the analysis for the court. I do want to turn to judicial admission.
Your time is up.
Oh, thank you, Your Honors.
Good morning, and may it please the court. The purpose of the Miranda warnings, as we see in both Miranda and in Innis, is to protect the defendant from the heightened compulsion beyond that inherent in custody itself.
Can you speak up just a little? The
yes,
air
I'm,
conditioning
I'm,
has come
I'm
on.
Sorry. I'm sorry. Okay.
And it's blowing right back here.
I will try to do better. Thank you. The purpose with the Miranda warnings is to protect the defendant from heightened compulsion beyond that inherent in custody itself. Now, take a case like Innis, where we have officers almost passive-aggressively saying, it would be bad if some children found this gun and got hurt by it, that led to the defendant telling the officers where the gun was. But in the Supreme Court of the United States held that that did not constitute interrogation. Now, as for a couple of threshold matters, first, I want to address the defense's claim that the state conceded error during closing argument. All of the statements made by the state were conditioned on the jury believing that Officer Malwitz should have Mirandized the defendant. If you look in the jury argument, and I believe it is, it's the initial jury argument is 17, volume 17, page 70. Where the first prosecutor said, if you want to believe that Officer Malwitz should have Mirandized the defendant before they headed down there, then your remedy for that would be only to not consider the statements she said in response to the questions he asked. And in rebuttal close on page 91, if you find that Officer Malwitz should have given the Miranda warnings, then disregard the statements that she made in response to any of his questions. And so these were not concessions of error, but rather involved if the jury believed that the defendant should have received her Miranda warnings. The second threshold matter I want to address is the standard of review. The abuse of discretion should be the standard applied in this case. Mason involved a case where the suppression hearing was tried on stipulation of facts, so there is no witness credibility for the trial court to evaluate. This case, although there was video that was entered both at the suppression hearing and at trial, The trial court heard testimony from both officers, evaluated their credibility, and implicitly found them to be credible. And so the state believes that abuse of discretion is the correct standard for this case.
Well, do you think that we can consider the evidence submitted at trial as the appellant is urging us?
I believe you can consider that. Although I would like to point out that Officer Malwitz's dash cam was admitted during the suppression hearing and contained almost all the same audio as what was entered at trial with the body cam. It included the question, do you want to add terroristic threat? It included the question later, like, why were you resisting us? And so I think that the trial court still had a good view of what the evidence was like, what possible compulsion was there. And so I would disagree with the defense in saying that it was to the state's advantage to withhold the Officer Malwitz's body camera until trial. The record in this case shows a lack of compulsion. Officer Malwitz did ask those questions at around 15 minutes in his body cam and then left for about 10 minutes to conduct a search of the hotel room that the appellant was staying at. After he did that, he returned, and what he returned to was the appellant yelling at him. She continued yelling at him for several minutes as they started driving, and eventually came to one point where she asked him, Officer Malwitz's name. After he gave his name, the appellant immediately asked, "How long do you think you're going to live?"
Let me interject real quick, Counselor. Just let me ask you, do you at least concede that there was a possibility that the defendant was still thinking about the questions that he asked her before the gap ensued?
I agree that she could have been thinking. I don't know how likely that necessarily is. But I think the intervening events, especially with the way that appellant was yelling at the officer when he came back, I think it shows that she wasn't under any sort of compulsion at that point. So after Officer Malwitz gave his name, that's when the appellant started threatening him. Again, all initiated by the appellant. Now, when the officer asked, "Do you want to add terroristic threat?" that is not like the questions that were asked in Mason. In Mason, after receiving a vague threat of, "Do you have a good boxing game?" the officer started asking questions like, "Are you threatening to assault me? Why are you trying to assault me? How do you propose to assault me?" All of which are questions that the officer reasonably should have known was reasonably likely to result in an incriminating response by Mason. In this case, Officer Malwist asked, "Do you want to add terroristic threat?" which, in my opinion, was his intent to try to get the appellant to stop threatening him. And therefore, he should not have reasonably known that it was likely to lead to more incriminating responses. Then they started talking about...
It was actually kind of a threat on his part. It's like, if you don't shut up, I'm going to add terroristic threat to this.
Well...
To me, that's... It wasn't really a question, it was rhetorical.
I agree, it was rhetorical. And the difference is that the officer has the right to add that charge if he has probable cause to believe that it's being committed. So then there's a fairly long discussion about what happened to appellant's car and why weren't the officers trying to find who had broken into it and why weren't they going east to try and find him. And then there was one other question about why did you start resisting us but that led to a response that was not inculpatory, not incriminating, and went right back to a discussion of the car. And it was only then that the threat started to get even more severe, and again, not in response to any questioning by Officer Malwitz. This is where the defendant started threatening Lieutenant Hamilton as well as Officer Malwitz and gave what I believe is...
I've got a question about that. The indictment only dealt with Malwitz, so can we consider the statements that were made against Hamilton?
Consider as far as whether the defendant committed the offense that was charged, no, but it still is relevant to show what the defendant's state of mind was at the time of the offense. And going to the state of mind, the defendant's final statement was, "Over my freedom, people can lose their lives," which clearly shows that it was in response to the officers performing that public duty. The defense's argument is that Malwitz's initial questioning taints the entire conversation. That is, question of why did you hide that stuff, or why were you screaming at us, means that everything that happened in the next 30 minutes on the ride to the jail and afterward is inadmissible. But we would agree with what the trial prosecutor said, which is that even if some of those questions were improper, the correct remedy is to disregard her responses to those questions, which would be harmless because nothing that she said was threatening or inculpatory of any offense. Now, I will briefly move over to the waiver of counsel issue. I think that this court's prior case, Glasspool, is very instructive in deciding this case. When the defendant has standby counsel and is fully aware that they have the ability to avail themselves of that standby counsel and choose not to, it shows that the Feretta admonishments are not required. That's because there's no question of waiver involved, as the Court of Criminal Appeals held in Maddox and Phillips, which is that in hybrid representation, because the defendant still has the assistance of counsel, there's no question of waiver, and there's no reason to treat hybrid representation and standby counsel differently.
And that was one of the sister courts, or our sister courts, correct, that case?
Glasspool was our case.
Yeah.
It was an unpublished opinion, but there have been sister courts who have issued published opinions on this matter. The defendant received these warnings both orally and in writing, and while appellant argues that there wasn't enough of an questioning into the defendant's background, education, criminal history, and life experience, there's no required formula for a waiver of right to counsel, and the trial court did not abuse its discretion when it found that the defendant knowingly and intelligently waived her right to counsel. Finally, we would argue that the defendant invited error by requesting to go pro se with standby counsel, given that that is exactly what the trial court offered to do and what the defendant eventually accepted. The court frequently asked the defendant if she wanted to have standby counsel step in and represent her, and every time she said that she wanted to represent herself, even to the point of closing argument where she wanted to split her time with standby counsel, and the trial court said she cannot, she chose to have her deliver closing argument. I want to touch on one last thing with regard to the suppression issue. One of the factors that the court used in Mason is that they found that the defendant was susceptible to interrogation because he was intoxicated, and this was known by the officer because he had arrested the defendant for public intoxication. But there's no indication in the video showing that the defendant was intoxicated. There was no reason for the officers to believe that the defendant was incompetent, which was, I believe, the main issue raised by the defendant when she litigated the motion to suppress pro se. She argued that her statements were involuntary because she was incompetent to stand trial. But that was not something the officers knew at the time of the offense. And so that factor in Mason would not apply to this case. And if I have no more questions, I will yield the rest of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, I'll try to be brief since my friend here finished early, so I'll try to do this as quickly as possible. Just touching on the judicial admission concept, I do want to point out that in closing jury argument, the second prosecutor actually defined the statements that she made in response to any of his questions as what happened in the car. These are the statements that happened in the car. And then the first prosecutor in the opening jury argument does the same. She defines the statements that she said in response to questions Malwitz asked as, well, she says this, what's not in response to the questions when he gets to the jail. So we would argue that as far as judicial admissions go, they've actually acknowledged which statements they believe are responsive to his interrogation, and that's everything in the car. Turning briefly to the state's argument about the application of the res geste concept, Mason actually considered what the potential applicability of that as well and decided not to apply it, so I just want to point that out for the court. I do believe one instructive case on how to address the issue here would be Brewer v. State, and it's an unpublished opinion, so I'll give you the citation I have here. The Westlaw citation is 2018 WL 388034, and then the Court of Appeals cause number is 08-14-00207. And in that case, at the police station, if I recall correctly, there were two officers who were questioning a defendant about offenses. They were actually speaking to him about activities of the Aryan Brotherhood to see if he could be a confidential informant. During that time, the defendant was cooperative and calm. During that time, also, the officers had not yet asked any questions about the offenses for which he was arrested. But when the officers later informed the defendant in that case, sorry, you can't be a confidential informant, the Court of Appeals says that the defendant became outraged, angry, high, out of control, and then he threatened the officers. And we believe that circumstance is a good comparison to the facts we have here and shows why the res geste argument should not apply here. Lastly, I just want to touch on harm briefly and mention that harm is not just the content of the word said, but it's also the visceral, auditory manner in which honesty speaks with the officer after or during the interrogation. And just by way of example, you know, if I stood here more calmly than I am now because I'm a little bit nervous, and if I said, you know, well, we're all going to die someday, maybe I even shrugged my shoulders, we're all going to die someday, probably no one would be that concerned, right? But if, you know, my face gets red, maybe I start to squirm at the podium, I even reach inside my jacket, and I cry out, we're all going to die someday, I would hope your bailiff would jump on me, right? And I think that's a good example and a good way to frame how it's not just the content, but it's everything that occurs after that that became admissible that we believe shows harm in any of the three fulcrums that I gave the court earlier. Unless the court has any other questions, I'll give my last minute back to the court.
Thank you. Gentlemen, we appreciate your arguments here today. It's been helpful to the court. Your case has now been submitted, and you are free to go. Thank you.